Where there's a will to tell a slightly creative accounting story, there's a way. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, August 5th. Glad you could join us. More today on the companies trying to find their way through this pandemic. Disney reported a rare quarterly loss yesterday, nearly $5 billion. But Disney stocks are soaring today because the company painted its numbers as a win. Steep losses in theme parks and cruises offset by its media and streaming operations and, says Disney, a helpful accounting decision. Marketplace's Mariel Segura explains.
Okay, so Disney pays for the rights to broadcast sports like baseball and basketball. And under corporate accounting rules, when companies crunch their quarterly numbers, they're not supposed to factor in costs from a purchase like that until they see the revenue. In this case, after the games air. Enter COVID. Disney didn't get to broadcast these games last quarter, which ended in June. Robert Rosten is CFO at the financial education firm Training the Street.
So essentially, they're saying since we haven't broadcasted their season, we haven't recognized this expense yet.
Which makes the company's results look better. Rosten says this is a standard accounting practice. Parts of it are subjective, though. Like, how much of the cost should Disney push to the future? Depends on whether it thinks all of the scheduled NBA and MLB games will actually air. Ellie Bartov at the NYU Stern School of Business says the pandemic has created a lot of uncertainty.
And since accounting involved a lot of estimate about the future, it makes the accounting numbers much less reliable.
The pandemic could also tempt some companies to cross the line. They might use accounting tricks to smooth out revenue so it looks steady from quarter to quarter. Or include other metrics in their financial statements that say, well, if it weren't for COVID, here's what our numbers would have looked like. Here's Robert Rosten again.
That has a time and a place, but we all know that you can't keep that up forever.
Because at a certain point, the pandemic becomes the new normal, and those kind of metrics can be misleading. I'm Mariel Segura for Marketplace.
Here's another story that's sort of about creative accounting. A California court is expected to hand down a big ruling tomorrow on how gig workers are classified. The state and several cities have asked for an injunction that would force Uber and Lyft to immediately reclassify their drivers as employees, not independent contractors. That classification is, of course, the key to these companies' business models. And during the pandemic, it's taken on even more significance for workers. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports from the Workplace Culture Desk.
It's all about the safety net. Traditional full-time employees, for the most part, have one to fall back on. Independent contractors like gig workers, not so much.
The option is between working or losing the roof over my head.
Lyft driver Idan Alva, who lives outside San Francisco, got sick in January, he thinks, with the regular flu.
And since I don't get sick days, there is no way for me to stop working. So I was working while having the symptoms, which I hate myself for doing it. It's dumb.
Paid leave, subsidized health insurance, unemployment benefits, they've all become crucial during the pandemic. They're also usually paid for by companies. New emergency laws like the Federal CARES Act have provided some of these benefits to workers who aren't full-time employees.
But I think it's just revealed how many holes we have for too many people in our economy in general.
David Weil is a professor at Brandeis University and author of The Fissured Workplace, about how the traditional work model the country's safety net was built on has been breaking down. That leaves some workers without benefits and government with fewer resources to respond to emergencies. Because gig platforms like Uber and Lyft don't pay into unemployment insurance like regular employers, the federal government is now shouldering the cost of providing relief to gig workers who've been sidelined by the pandemic, and state unemployment trust funds are quickly running out of money. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
So behind this week's happenings around TikTok, President Trump basically ordering a Chinese company to sell it, Microsoft being given permission to acquire it, behind all that is an obscure government panel with a lot of power. It's called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. It includes representatives from the Departments of State, Commerce, Defense, and Justice, among others, and it's chaired by the U.S. Department of Treasury. It isn't well known, but its decisions have big impacts. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look behind the curtain.
Washington loves acronyms. The Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States is known as CFIUS.
It's a terrible, terrible name.
David Hanke is a partner at the law firm Arent Fox. He says the name and the committee were created back in the mid-1970s because of fears that wealthy OPEC countries would buy U.S. firms. Hanke says if CFIUS thinks an acquisition of a U.S. company could help a foreign country, say, spy or get a hold of sensitive technology, boom, the deal's dead.
One Wall Street executive has called CFIUS the ultimate regulatory bazooka.
It's not clear what the bazooka would be aiming at in the Microsoft TikTok deal. James Lewis at the Center for Strategic and International Studies watched 700 TikTok videos in an effort to find out.
Jumping in pools, riding your bike, you know, having your mom yell at you.
Lewis says the danger isn't the videos. It's if China kept some control over TikTok after Microsoft bought it.
They could choose to use TikTok as a delivery vehicle for malicious software.
Deborah Gaddison-Hatter, a partner at Clark Hill Strasburger, says CFIUS could force limits on any remaining Chinese investment in TikTok.
That investor couldn't have a board seat or could be limited in the types of information it would be able to receive.
If CFIUS nixes the deal, it would be hard for Microsoft to appeal. Courts generally don't hear CFIUS cases because it's a matter of national security. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, the S&P 500 was within spitting distance of a record close today. We'll have some figures a little more relevant to your lives when we do the numbers. As of July, the APM Research Lab reports that Black Americans are almost four times more likely than white Americans to die from COVID-19. Overall, Black and brown people are dying at far higher rates than white people. But in the world of medicine, algorithms and artificial intelligence increasingly help doctors make decisions about care, and race is written into those algorithms. A paper published in June in the New England Journal of Medicine gave an example of widely used software that estimates how well a patient's kidneys are functioning because that's hard to test directly. The algorithm uses race, among other factors, to make those guesses, and that can affect who gets a kidney transplant and who doesn't. But here's the thing.
Race is a social and not a biological construct.
Leo Eisenstein is a physician at NYU and Bellevue Hospitals and one of the authors of the paper.
We're seeing differences in outcomes, not because people who are Black have essentially different bodies, but their experience of being Black in this country is essentially different.
But encoded in the world of healthcare is the idea that Black and brown bodies are different. And as a result,
there's an excuse for why there are inequalities of health in the notion that these are produced naturally by racial differences.
Dorothy Roberts is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and author of the book Fatal Invention: How Science, Politics, and Big Business Recreate Race in the 21st Century.
People will say, you know, Black race predicts for some bad outcome when it's actually structural racism that's operating to put people in a vulnerable position where they are at risk.
Roberts talks about one study that examined why Black women in Chicago started dying from breast cancer at a much higher rate than white women beginning in the 1990s.
Researchers concluded it was not because Black women's health got worse. It was because there had been huge advances in breast cancer detection and treatment over those 20 years. And the best machines are located in private hospitals where more advantaged people go.
Roberts said that history makes her deeply worried about the government and hospital rules that could determine who gets the life-saving technology to treat or prevent COVID-19.
There are ways in which racism is built into these rationing guidelines, which are based on a premise that scarce resources shouldn't be wasted on someone who might die at the hospital. Now, because we live in a society that is structured by racism, this tool is systematically going to discriminate against Black patients because they have already experienced a society that is set up in a way to produce lower life expectancy for them.
A handful of hospitals around the country have stopped incorporating race into the algorithm that predicts kidney function and can affect who gets a kidney transplant. But Robert said changing algorithms is just one part, and the solutions need to be systemic.
Just because you're good at math and tech doesn't mean you understand the social contexts and inputs that are going to make a difference in the algorithm. And I always say, if scientists are going to get into the business of social policy, they cannot just rely on what's in their heads.
Dorothy Roberts is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Marketplace Tech produced an hour-long special on this and other innovations around COVID-19. You can hear that all week on public radio stations or online at marketplace.org. Coming up,
it comes down to me to this enduring phenomenon of caste.
Social stratification and race in this economy. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 373 points, 1.3%, to close at 27,201. The NASDAQ was up 57 points, 0.5%, to end at 10,998. And the S&P 500 rose 21 points, 0.6%, to end at 3,327. Airline traffic fell about 70% from this time last year as the COVID-19 pandemic put some travelers, most travelers, off flying. But let's look at gas prices because a lot of folks are taking road trips. They held steady this week at $2.18 a gallon, according to figures released Monday by AAA. Spokespeople say that's about the cheapest in a decade. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 0.54%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. It's clear that a lot of working parents, including me, are still going to have kids at home well into the rest of this year and perhaps beyond. Some of those parents are hiring nannies, and many have a new job qualification on their lists, a request that could come with unintended consequences. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
When Nicolette Satolo wants to get kids to do something they don't want to do, she makes up a song about it. Like this one.
This is the way we brush our teeth. We brush them every day. We brush the bottoms. We brush the bottoms. We brush the bottoms. Hooray! Kind of goes like that.
Satola has worked as a nanny for 17 years. She's also trained as a personal chef and taken classes in positive discipline. She lives in Charleston, South Carolina, and is looking for work. One thing not on her resume that's kept her from getting some jobs? The fact that she hasn't had the coronavirus. Several families told her they're only looking for someone who's already gotten sick.
I wasn't surprised. I've been talking to other nannies, and they're getting asked the same thing.
In Brooklyn, nanny Anna Garcia was actually sick with COVID-19 in March. She's healthy now and saw a job posting in a parents group on Facebook looking for a caregiver who'd already had the virus. Garcia applied, but said it felt strange to talk about being a coronavirus survivor with her potential boss.
It's just all these weird questions. It's no longer as before, where they were more focused on how many years you've been working, your references. Now it's if you're sick, if you have been sick, and how long have you been symptom-free.
Scientists still don't know how much protection COVID antibodies provide, but parents are grasping onto anything they believe could keep their families safe. Katie Provinziano runs the nationwide placement agency, Westside Nannies.
Their hope is that maybe if this nanny has had it before, she won't get it again, and we won't be exposed to it.
Provinziano doesn't screen candidates based on whether they've had the virus, but there's very little regulation of families who hire caregivers on their own. The Americans with Disabilities Act prevents employers from asking workers to take an antibody test, but that law only applies to households when they have 15 or more people on staff.
You know, you basically have to be Great Gatsby territory.
Samuel Bagenstos is a professor of labor and employment law at the University of Michigan. Many older labor laws intentionally left out domestic workers, who are mainly women of color.
a lot of this emerged from the 1930s at a time when there was overt race and sex bias in the legislative process. And so we actually see people describing why they're doing this.
A bill introduced in Congress last year would create new anti-discrimination protections for domestic workers. But Bagenstos worries that if families favor caregivers who've already had the virus, nannies might deliberately try to become sick.
People are going to be put in this sort of deadly dilemma of, do I infect myself in order to work, or do I protect my life at the expense of my livelihood?
There are historical precedents for this kind of behavior. Yellow fever was a huge problem in the 1800s in southern cities like New Orleans. There was no treatment for it, and people who hadn't had the disease had a harder time getting jobs and housing. Catherine Olivares is a professor of history at Stanford who studies that period.
I've seen examples of people jumping into the beds of their dead friends, roaming around in their bedsheets hoping to get sick.
There are other new requirements besides antibodies. Several nanny agencies say they've seen requests for living caregivers triple since the start of the pandemic. Nicolette Satola, the nanny in South Carolina, turned down a live-in position to care for a girl who was born with a lung condition. The family didn't want her to leave the property.
To be asked, kind of give up your own life, it's a lot. It's a lot for any nanny.
But even if these nannies get jobs, there's the issue of pay. Some families have never hired nannies before and may not know how much it costs. Others might just be trying to get a deal. Anna Garcia, the nanny in Brooklyn, has 10 years of experience and usually makes $22 an hour to watch two kids. Recently, she's been offered much less.
I feel like a lot of families are taking advantage at the same time of the pandemic. A lot of nannies, and including myself, are being offered, $14, $15 an hour for two kids. It's like, that's no.
Garcia hasn't been able to get a full-time job since she was sick. Because while she is willing to answer personal questions about her health in order to get work, she isn't willing to take a pay cut. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
We've been talking a lot on this show lately about racism and how it's an economic issue. But what if racism isn't even a big enough word to explain the inequality embedded within this economy? That's part of what Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Isabel Wilkerson explores in her new book, Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents. Marketplace's Kai Rizdahl, you know him, spoke with her about it last week. We're going to play that conversation for you now.
Isabel Wilkerson, it is great to have you back on the program. I want to start with an observation about your first book, The Warmth of Other Suns, which just parenthetically, I cannot recommend highly enough to everybody. You note in the first chapter of this, your new book, that you wrote Warmth of Other Suns, 500-600 pages, whatever it is, and not once did you use the word racism. And I want to know why.
That is correct. I spent time telling the story of 6 million people, African-Americans, who fled the Jim Crow South. And I found that the word racism was insufficient to capture the rigid social hierarchy and the repression that they were born into and that they were fleeing. And so I adopted the term caste and caste system to convey the enormity of what they were dealing with there.
For those Americans and those anywhere, actually, listening to this interview, who can't see the caste system in action every day, what does it look like in this economy?
Well, it looks like COVID-19 in many respects. We could see that those people who were on the front lines, particularly in the early going of this pandemic, they were people who were brown and black people who were most likely to be at risk of being out in the public, stacking shelves at a grocery store or delivering goods to people or driving buses and public transportation, which meant that they were at greater risk of contracting the virus and then also greater risk also of dying. You know, one of the things that I describe the caste system as being, it's like a house. It's like a house with joists and beams within them. And we can't see those, but we can see what's the external. And it's the external is what kind of indicates where you would fit in the caste system. Caste is the bones and race is the skin. And that is how we've come to see ourselves and where people belong within the hierarchy.
I want to detour a second from the macro to the anecdotal here with you and your experience in this economy and in your professional life and in writing this book. Tell me the story of that interview you tried to do in Chicago with that business owner when you were with the New York Times.
So I was a national correspondent with the New York Times based in Chicago. I'm doing a fairly routine story. I call up these people, many, many people who I want to interview. All the interviews go fine until I get to the end of the day, at which point I show up at this establishment. The gentleman that I'm there to interview is the manager of the establishment. And as I go up to him, he says to me immediately, "Oh, I can't talk with you now. I'm very, very busy. I'm getting ready for an extremely important interview. I can't talk with you right now." And so I said, "I think that I'm your interview. I think that's the interview. I'm Isabel Wilkerson with the New York Times." He said, "Well, how do I know that? Do you have a business card?" And I said, "Well, it's the end of the day, and I unfortunately am sorry, I'm out of my business cards." He said, "Well, what kind of ID do you have? Do you have some ID that I could see?" And I said, "Well, I shouldn't have to show you my ID, but I here's my driver's license so you could see." And he said, "Well, you don't have anything with the New York Times on it." And I said, "I am the only person here. I have indicated that I'm Isabel Wilkerson and I'm here to interview you." And he said, "I'm going to have to ask you to leave because I am expecting the New York Times at any minute." And so I walked out the door as he still stood there waiting for the interview that was supposed to have happened and that he missed.
Keep going, because as you describe it, you were shaken by this.
I was. It was demoralizing. I mean, it turned out that I was able to finish the piece without him. But this is an example, though, of the effect that this can have on the economy as a whole. If you multiply what happened to me in that moment times the millions upon millions of people who are marginalized in our country, who are trying to just go about their day getting the work done and are thwarted for some, you know, for this perceived assumption about them based upon where they should fit in the hierarchy, who's expected to be where and who's expected to be doing what. And so it took a very long time actually to recover from, and it's still very difficult to talk about. I had never been accused of impersonating myself, and it took a while to really figure out what was that. And it comes down to me to this enduring phenomenon of caste.
This is not a book about solutions, right? You're pretty clear about that. But I want to pick up on the thing you said about housing and caste being the framing and race being the skin. You also describe the challenge that is now upon us, because when you have a house and it's got a flaw or a leak in the roof, as you point out, you know, it might have happened 40 years ago that the defect was there, but now you own the house and you got to fix it. And now we own this economy and this society, and we got to fix it. Are you in this moment hopeful?
I am hopeful. I'm hopeful because, first of all, I wouldn't have written it if I didn't see some hope. I am saying this is the condition of the house. I've taken an infrared light. I've provided an X-ray of what the building's condition happens to be at the moment. And it's then up to all of us who are the inheritors of this house, all of us who currently live in this house, to come together to figure out how we are going to rectify the things that might be wrong with the building that we all live in. And it will take all of us to come together to heal from a caste system, a hierarchy that has been in effect for hundreds of years. It will take all of us.
Most recent book from Isabel Wilkerson is called Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents. Ms. Wilkerson, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
We've got an excerpt from Isabel Wilkerson's new book at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out. As we mentioned on the show yesterday, TikTok is probably Facebook's biggest standalone competition. But just at the moment when TikTok is under attack by the U.S. government, Facebook has launched basically an identical product that's part of Instagram. It's called Reels, and it's rolling out in the U.S. today, because never let a good government intervention go to waste. Before we go, a moment of economic context. Chicago's public school district announced that it will start school 100% online in September. Of the 25 biggest school districts in the country, only 5 are planning any in-person education. That is a lot of working parents at home with learning kids. Our media production team includes Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, J.C. Bold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. And I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.